So this morning we're jumping back into the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John is the telling of the life of Jesus by one of his closest friends and followers, a guy named John. Today we'll be starting back up in John chapter 12. John 12 is the last chapter of Jesus' public ministry that's recorded in the Gospel of John. Up until this point, we've read about the interactions that Jesus has been having with different people. We've seen that he performs miracles. But after this chapter, we sort of shift gears and we see Jesus' final days with his disciples. The conversations that he has, what he prays for them. We see his arrest, his trial, his crucifixion, and ultimately his resurrection and the final days that he spends with his disciples after that. But this morning, we're specifically in John chapter 12, verse 1 to 11. If you're just joining us and you weren't here when we were going through John last winter and spring, that's okay. You can easily catch up. I would encourage you, if you have the opportunity, or maybe you've been with us and John has just started to get rusty over this upcoming week, maybe just read the first 11 chapters of John. See where we have come already and what we've been reading and studying. If you don't have a Bible, you can feel free to pick one up at one of the tables at the exits of the auditorium, or you can also feel free to download the app. I suggest the YouVersion Bible app. I think it's hands down the best Bible app there is. It's on the Google Store, the App Store, whatever you want to, wherever you want to go. It's on all the platforms. So download that and dive into the Gospel of John. Let me begin by reading what this morning's passage is, and then we'll go from there and see how this applies to our own life. John chapter 12, verse 1 to 11. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here, a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Then, Mary took a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Leave her alone, Jesus replied. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came, not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plan to kill Lazarus as well, for on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing in him. That's a lot that took place at one dinner. I mean, if we go back, we can see sort of some of the context that surrounds this story. We see that Jesus has actually just returned from hiding out in a little town near the wilderness where he was staying with his disciples. Jesus and his disciples were there because the local religious rulers wanted Jesus dead. Not only had Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, but he was putting the Pharisees and their religious system in jeopardy. If the Romans, who were the political leaders at the time, could have heard about or caught wind of what was happening, about this rebellion and this faction amongst the Jewish people, it was likely that they could come in and squash it, that they would take away the temple from the Pharisees, and then they would sort of run them out of town. And so the Pharisees see that really there's no dealing with Jesus. They've tried to bait him, they've tried to catch him, they've tried to compromise with him, but it seems impossible. There's this growing enthusiasm happening amongst the people where they're coming to Jesus and wanting to know more. So now they've decided that Jesus has to be eliminated. So this is all going on in the background, but the time of Passover is coming. Passover is a very important festival in the Jewish calendar. And so Jesus heads into Bethany, which is just outside of Jerusalem, for Passover preparations. There would be some ceremonial cleaning that would go on. He would be praying and working through the Torah and preparing his heart for that time. And so he heads in, And then this is where we find this event that takes place. And then from here on, as we go through John, we're going to see that quickly a number of events will take place that ultimately lead us to Jesus' death. But in the midst of all this, in the midst of the preparations before the Passover, Jesus' friends decide to throw him a dinner in his honor. They say, well, this guy, he's just raised Lazarus from the dead. I think that's worthy of a party. If you look through the different gospel accounts, you'll actually see that a number of them talk about this very event. And I'm so appreciative that we have four gospels, because sometimes we can use one gospel to fill in the details. Because here we don't know where is this dinner happening. We just know in Bethany. But if you go to the gospels of Matthew and Mark, we see this story is also recorded there. And so from there, we find out that this meal is happening at the home of Simon the leper. Now, it's unlikely here that Simon had leprosy at the time, because people wouldn't have dinner in a leper's home. My suspicion is, personal suspicion, is that Simon has probably been healed by Jesus. I think he was a man who was healed by Jesus, because Jesus would go through towns and he would heal many people. We see that through the Gospels, where we don't hear all the stories, but the writers will say, and Jesus healed other people, or there's many things that Jesus did that aren't recorded here. But I think that Jesus healed this man, this Simon, which was a common name, but I think they did this so that this event could occur. Now, that's just me kind of putting conjecture out there, but I think that, and I think that's supported by the fact that when the gospel writers would include someone's name, we think they did this for a very specific reason. We think that they would do this so that when the first people who heard this story of Jesus' life wanted to know if it was true or not, they could certainly go out and find an individual. They could go to them and say, hey, tell me about this story. Tell me if this is true or not. And so it seems that it would be unlikely that they would choose to name a leper for a couple of reasons. The first is in Matthew, where it talks about Simon the leper. We know that Matthew was concerned with a Jewish audience. And for Jews, someone who had leprosy was considered unclean. They would be separated and segregated from society so as not to make anyone else unwell. And so it seems strange that he would include this person's name and say, hey, you guys go and ask this guy who did this stuff whether or not the story is true. And so that doesn't make sense. And second, lepers just had a short attention lifespan. And it seems to me that it would have been unlikely that he would include somebody who would possibly die shortly thereafter. And so whether or not that is true, that's sort of the picture, the context that I see, but we do know for certain that it was at his home. So we see Jesus and his disciples, Lazarus and Simon, reclining at a table. I think this would have been the most fascinating dinner table conversation that has ever happened. I've had some great dinner table conversations myself, but never have I been at a dinner table where someone's been raised from the dead. So I'm sure there would be a lot of conversation going, how did you do that? What's going on here? What's all this about? And people would be asking about the events that are surrounding this. Jesus, where have you been? You left town after this happened. What's going on? What's happening with you and these Pharisees who are trying to get you? So all this conversation is happening around a table. And these dinners, as we know from first century customs, would have been long and stretched out. It would have taken the whole evening, most likely. And so they're gathered around, they're socializing, they're in this man's home. And we see that in the middle of this dinner at some point, maybe it was during a socialization period between some food or some drink, that Mary is Lazarus' sister. She gets up and a pint of pure nard is poured out on Jesus. This is a big deal. Nard was a very expensive spice. It had to be imported from northern India, Tibet, or China. So this spice has traveled a long way. And it was a spice that was expensive even when it was cut with other spices. Because what they would do, the merchants at the time, would take some nard because it was this beautiful, expensive spice, and they would turn it into a perfume or an ointment, and then they would cut in a bunch of other stuff so they could kind of spread it out and sell it for more. But this was pure nard. Nard is a spice that has a sweet scent. It's red in color. It would have been used in a variety of things, from medical purposes to a perfume. And a pint of this is roughly a half liter. So we know she's got about a half liter of this perfume. And according to what we see that Judas says, this is worth 300 denarii. 300 denarii is 1 year's wage for a day laborer. We know that they would get roughly one per day, and a laborer couldn't work on any of the Sabbath days or during any of the Jewish festivals. So this was a full year's salary, one person's full year's salary that was in this bottle. So it makes me speculate, and many others, I'm sure, go, how did Mary get her hands on something this expensive? Was she wealthy? Is this some type of family heirloom? How did she get this? Because a typical Jewish family, there's no way they could afford this. There's just absolutely no way, a whole year's salary saved up. But ultimately, we don't know how that came to be, how she got it. But we see that she does something with it, something so special. She chooses to anoint Jesus. In this account, we read that she pours it out on his feet. In Matthew's account, we see that his head is anointed, so it's poured onto his head. Some people have an issue with this. Some people see these different gospel accounts and go, well, why does one person say the feet and another say the head? But I mean, it's 500 milliliters of oil. That's a lot of oil. I think we can go to a place and say, okay, it makes sense that both the head and the feet could have been anointed. And we also have to pay attention because Matthew and John are writing to different audiences. So they're putting different subtleties to make different points. And Matthew was stressing Jesus' kingship here. We see that a king in the context of the day would be anointed by oil being poured on their head. And John, he was stressing about Jesus being glorified in death. And culturally, this works because they would anoint a deceased body on the feet. So either way, we read in verse 3 that the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. Imagine being in a house filled with the sweet scent of perfume. I mean, for me to contextualize that, I think of walking into Bath and Body Works or a Lush store or a Sage, you know, those places where it's aromatherapy or soap, and you go in and you smell all these wonderful smells. But sometimes it can bombard you, right? Because there's like 1,000 smells in there. But here in this moment, there's only one scent, this beautiful, rich, sweet aroma that can only come from this exotic spice. And so they breathe it in. It's all around them. And there, Mary takes her hair and lets it down and begins to wipe Jesus' feet. This is something that would not be okay culturally. For a woman didn't let her hair down in public. A woman's hair was to be seen only by her husband. And so here Mary acts with abandon. But it's an extravagant abandon. It's this massive expression of love. And while she's doing that, we see that in the room, Judas is there, and Judas sharply criticizes her. He says, that perfume could have been sold and the money given to the poor. What are you doing, Mary? And then what happens? We see John interject something here. I like this. I like this stuff in the Gospels where the writers just add something in because he points out Judas is a thief and the guy who's going to betray Jesus. This was recorded certainly long after Jesus had died. And so he was probably pretty miffed, right? Like, he's probably pretty mad at Judas. Here's somebody he's traveled with. He's been a companion alongside. He spent a lot of time probably building a friendship. And this guy goes and betrays Jesus. And they also find out that he had been a thief, stealing from the group's money bag. And so he includes that, and he includes Jesus' response, which says, leave her alone. It was intended that she should have this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. Now, if you take what Judas said off the top, right, that this perfume could have been used to be sold and give money to the poor, it seems like a pretty dignified thing. It sounds very legitimate to me. But of course, it becomes completely worthless. You can kind of throw out his complaint when you know what's going on in the background. It's a treasurer who steals money from his own treasury. So Jesus goes on and he shuts him down, and then he tells him that Mary was saving this perfume for Jesus' burial. What Mary didn't actually know was that Jesus was about to die shortly thereafter. But Mary's actions, like Jesus' words, are often layered. Her actions meant far more than she ever possibly intended. So Jesus is letting them know that he was now figuratively being prepared for the days which were coming, the days that would lead to his death and his burial. And I suspect that with that much oil, with 500 milliliters of oil poured upon him, there's a good chance that that scent could have lingered on him and in his clothes all the way to the cross. So those were Jesus' final words to Judas in this story, that what would be happening is that the poor would always be among them, but they would not always have Jesus. If you were a Jew in Jesus' day, this would have created a lot of tension for you, most likely, because all of the Jews in the day would know this passage that comes from Deuteronomy chapter 15, verse 11. It says, "There will always be poor people in the land. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed towards your fellow Israelites who are poor and needy in your land." The Israelites were commanded by God to care for the poor, care for the needy, and so they were supposed to do what they could to support them. And so I think that likely Judas might have been calling upon that, and those in the room would likely agree that, yeah, we're supposed to do that, we're supposed to care. Here's this rabbi, we're supposed to be a part of that. But there's this tension. Because Jesus isn't denying the responsibility to the poor. No, in fact, if you look through his teachings, he often calls people. One of his main mandates is go to the widow, to the poor, to those who are foreign. But he doesn't deny the responsibility to the poor, but he alerts us to the wonder of who is being hosted at that dinner on that day. And we see while all this is going on that John provides a little more background. That outside of the house, there's people coming. There's people coming to see Jesus and Lazarus, to see what Jesus has done. And they want to believe in this guy, Jesus, because of both his teaching and because of what he did in the life of Lazarus, of bringing him back from the dead. So as we look at the story, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of layered elements that we see impact lives, but through it we see five responses to Jesus. There's five sets of responses. The first four are by people who know Jesus, and the last is by someone who doesn't. I'd suggest that we all respond to Jesus in one manner or another. Some of us respond positively to Jesus, others negatively. Some of us are passionate towards him, others apathetic. But my question this morning will be, which of these responses speaks to you? Which of these do you need to work on within your own life? The first response we see is Martha's response. Martha's busy serving Jesus. There's a dinner put on in Jesus' honor, and so she gets to work. I suspect that she's whipping together one awesome party. There's a reason that Martha Stewart has her name. Okay, maybe not. But just go with me for a moment. Someone has just done something amazing for a family member. Imagine today if you had a sibling or a child who was sick and someone decided to donate an organ to them. They recovered. They get better. Now you have the opportunity to have that person in your home. What are you going to do? You're going to throw an amazing party. You're going to do the most lavish dinner party that you have ever done. You are going to scrape every dish. You're going to polish the cutlery. You're going to scrub your floors. You're going to do it all. The finest food and drink you can muster, a five-course meal you're going to put on in that person's honor. And so here, Jesus has done something that none of us can do. He's brought Martha's brother back from the dead. And so she not only throwing a dinner party for that, but she also considers Jesus to be her Lord. And so she's putting on a dinner party for God. That's a pretty impressive thing. And so she's doing all of this as an act of love, as a response to Jesus. For some of us here today, this needs to be a response that we incorporate into our lives. Many of us love and appreciate Jesus, but we don't serve him. Naturally, when we love someone, our desire is to do something for that person, to give them our best that we are able to serve them. One of my favorite pictures of this is the movie The Princess Bride. If you've ever seen it, Princess Buttercup has this young gentleman who serves her named Wesley. And Wesley serves and adores Princess Buttercup. And whenever she asks him to do something, he says three words. As you wish. That's right. And to him that is saying, I love you and I will serve you. So do you need to say to God, as you wish? The second response we see is Lazarus's response. Lazarus is reclining at the table with Jesus. I mean, can you blame the guy? He's just been brought back from the dead. He's just hanging out. He's relaxing. He's just died and been raised back to life. I'm sure he's asking Jesus a lot of questions. They say that when you experience a near-death experience, one of the things that that does for you is it puts your life priorities in sequence, that it tells you what you need to spend the most amount of time doing. And so here we see that Lazarus' response to his death situation is this, that I'm going to spend time with Jesus. That is what was most important to Lazarus. For me this week, as I went through this passage and looked at the five responses, I said, God, what do I need to incorporate in my life? Which of these do I need to work on most? And I asked him to reveal that to me. And here in this passage, this is where I landed. And he led me onwards to a psalm, which I'm going to get to in a second. But I have a problem incorporating rest into my life. I just had an annual review here at the church, and one of the things the elders told me is, Kyle, you need to rest. My parents came from out of town for Christmas and said, Kyle, you need to rest. My wife often tells me, Kyle, you need to rest. And I don't like shutting off because I love what I do. I love every part of my life. And so I just go full board, but sometimes stupidly. I mean, I get it. Intellectually, I can totally piece together the fact that I need rest. Intellectually, I understand that I need silence and solitude, and I need to spend more time with God where I'm not asking him to teach me something to reveal on a Sunday or what to, you know, answer my prayers or whatever it is. And so I intellectually get that, but for me to push it down is very hard. And so as I was asking God for this week, and as I started talking, I was reading through some Psalms, and I came to Psalm 27, verse 4. And this is what I'm going to start meditating on. This is something that I need to start working on in my life. It's this. It says, one thing I ask from the Lord, this only do I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord and to seek his temple. I think that's what Lazarus was doing. That's what I need to do. So do you, like me, need to spend more time gazing on the beauty of Jesus? The third response we see is Mary's response. Mary responds with sacrifice. She sacrifices two of the most valuable things in the world to her. She sacrifices a prized possession, and she sacrifices her pride. First, she sacrifices a prized possession, this bottle of nard perfume, a year's wages, not easily accrued again, because she recognizes that there is something more important than this thing. That importance is honoring Jesus. This is an act that God continually calls for from his people through history, to give up the things that stand as idols in our lives. And unfortunately, stuff is sometimes one of them. God asks us to surrender all sorts of things, though. He asks Abraham to be willing to sacrifice his son. He didn't make them do it, but he asked. He asked the Israelites to give up a home. We see through the early church and their conviction that they felt that they needed to sacrifice their finances, to sell everything, to pool it together to help others. And in Romans, we see what Paul tells us is asked, that we give up our lives, everything, that we offer it as a living sacrifice. So Mary sacrifices her pride possession, but she also sacrifices one of those other idols that she has, an idol that many of us have, which is our pride. She lets down her hair in front of other people. She wipes Jesus' feet with this pride possession, and she sacrifices her dignity and pride while she does it. She shows him that she would give him something far beyond monetary value. She wants to go beyond monetary value and give herself to him. There's a pastor and missionary named C.T. Studd, and I love this quote from him. It says, "If Jesus Christ be God and died for me, then no sacrifice can be too great for me to make for him." This is why, as a church, we call people to a radical level of generosity. It's actually why we've set our measures of what shows us as a successful church as generosity, because that we believe that everyone, in response to Jesus, in response to him being God and his sacrifice, should give up generously with glad hearts our time, our talents, our resources. We believe this not because we feel like we have to contribute towards a church, but because we want to honor God in everything. But like Mary, we don't think that giving this stuff up is a waste. When we invest our time and our talents towards what the church is doing, we are actually physically contributing to seeing life change. We are doing that because Jesus uses us to draw people closer to himself, to act as transformative catalysts in people's lives. And so when we sacrifice those things, we're laying ourselves on the line to see something amazing occur. Something that only God can do through us if we give ourselves up. When we talk about investing our resources, we talk about it because we recognize that everything we have, all our resources, ultimately belong to God. So giving back to God is a way for us to tell him that we're grateful for what we have and that we trust him with everything he has given us. So do you need to honor God with your time, your talents, or your resources? The fourth response is Judas's response. Now, Judas's words weren't directed right at Jesus, but we see that Jesus jumped on it because there was a heart issue in the midst. Judas was a self-righteous guy. He wanted to look good, right? I think we all want to look good, but he wants to look like he has compassion on the poor, and it makes him look good, but at the same time, he knows that a little extra money in the treasury can line those pockets, and so he says, man, we should sell all this and help the poor. But there's two problems here. The first problem was that he was in the presence of God and actually failed to recognize God. He said he followed Jesus, and he might have physically, but it was in this moment he actually following Jesus with his heart. That was a mistake, a big mistake, but a mistake all of us can make. The second problem was the self-righteousness. This puffed up nature, this greed, ended up squishing out genuine compassion. I read a great quote this last week by a guy named D.A. Carson. He said, "If self-righteous piety snuffs out genuine compassion, it must be admitted with shame that social activism, even that which meets real needs, sometimes masks a spirit that knows nothing of worship and adoration." This is a trap we can all easily fall into, that we serve others because we think it makes us look good. That we serve others because others will then look at us and be like, that person's a great person. Maybe we do it in the church. That person's a great person. That's a good Christian that I want to admire. And there's nothing wrong with serving and feeling good while you serve. That's one of the great things about service. That's why I encourage people to serve, is because it does wonderful work in our life. It gives us value that we are serving God by what we do. It also is just a positive thing that allows transformation to happen in our own hearts and lives. But there's a problem if we squish out the real service with making it about ourselves. If we make serving self-focused in any way, we're missing out on that key element, the worship and adoration of God. So for each one of us who serves in whatever capacity we serve in, we have to ask ourselves, why do I do this? And if it's for any reason other than serving God, you need a change of heart. If you serve in this church and you are serving for a self-focused reason, you need to change your heart or you need to get out of that ministry. We would rather have a ministry gap within our church, one where we have to work hard to fill because you are a valuable player, but we would rather see that empty than see somebody leading with the wrong motives. Why we serve is we serve to worship and adore Jesus. The last response we see to Jesus is the response of the people who do not yet know him. People decided to investigate who Jesus was. They talked to Lazarus to see the difference that Lazarus had just made in Jesus' life, and they begin to follow Jesus because of this. If you're here this morning and you're seeking answers, whether you're a skeptic or a doubter, whether you're a Christian who feels like you've sort of lost your way, I would encourage you to look at what God has done. Reading the Gospel of John is a great place to start. You can see in the Bible the accounts and the records of what Jesus did in the lives of other people. But go beyond that. Go to actual people. Go and talk to somebody who says that Jesus has changed their life and ask them. Inquire. See what God has done in their lives. Hear all about it. Because I promise that the exploration of Jesus is worth everyone's time. So the choice is ours. How will we respond to Jesus? If you're a follower of him, it's likely that maybe you've incorporated some of these. You've incorporated the response of Martha or of Mary or of Lazarus, maybe even of Judas. Hopefully that's not a part of your life right now. But you've started to incorporate these. But I would encourage you, like what I've done, I needed to go to God and say, God, what am I missing out on? Where am I missing at worshiping and adoring you? Where am I missing out on what you are doing in my life and the life of those around me? So I'd encourage you to spend some time thinking about it. Spend some time talking to God and actually waiting upon an answer to see how you can respond to him. Let's pray.